That's nice. Now, this is the beginning of volume 9, and we start with March the 10th, 1909. The Father forms one single thing with Jesus. We would say the Father and Jesus are one. One single thing is just the awkward translation. Jesus gives himself continuously for souls. Okay. So, continuing my usual state, Louisa said, I found myself outside of myself with the baby Jesus in my arms, and I said to him, tell me, our pretty little one, what does the Father do? That's really funny. You know, he's obviously sitting up on his throne, having nothing to do because he's millions of servants, you know. And he said, the Father and I are one. Now, that's John 10, 29. The Father and I are one. And it's also verse 38, John 10, 29 and 38. Okay. So you will find as we go along in these volumes that Jesus will say to her over and over again, but we have to have things repeated before they actually register, isn't that right? That it was one thing to create the universe and it's quite another matter to preserve it in creation. And so the Father is working rather hard. Okay, so Louisa said, and with the saints, what do you do? Now, there's your image of the saints sitting on a cloud playing the harp, you know. And he said, I give myself continuously. So I am their life, their joy, their happiness, their immense good, without end and without boundaries. Look at the without boundaries. God is love without boundaries. We put boundaries of race and religion and absolutely everything. He is love without boundaries. They are filled with me and they find everything in me. I am everything for them and they are all for me. Now that's John 14, 20 to 21. And it's also Galatians 2:20, I no longer live, Christ lives in me. Galatians 2:20. So on hearing this, I wanted to get huffy, she said. And I said to him, to the saints you give yourself continuously, but to me then, so meagerly, so stingily, look who she's talking to. And at intervals, to the point of having me spend part of the day without you coming, you understood, without your coming. And sometimes you hold off so much that the fear comes to me that you may not come even until evening. Now, she's not able to tolerate a couple of hours without him. The rest of us have to tolerate most of our lives, okay? So I live dying, she said, with the most cruel and ruthless death. Yet you told me that you loved me very much. And he replied, my daughter, to you also I give myself continuously. She can't, she won't, absolutely won't accept that his indwelling her is enough. Okay. And that, of course, the divine will has to keep us preserved as well. He said, I give myself continuously, I give myself personally, and I give myself by grace. I give myself through light and in many other ways. I just turned that into English for you. Is that all right? And then, who can deny that I love you very, very much? Now, at that moment, a thought came to me, Louisa said, of asking whether my state was the will of God. Now, she's got to stop this. This is volume 9. For that was more necessary than what I was saying to him, she said. So I told him, and he, instead of answering me, drew near my mouth and placed his tongue in my mouth, and I was no longer able to speak. Well, he found out in the end how to do it. I could just suckle something, she said, but I can't tell what it was. And as he withdrew, I could only say, Lord, come back soon. He has to use all kinds of methods to shut her up. So April the 1st, very good date, isn't it? 1909. Jesus bejewels the soul with gems that come from suffering. Put the ring around suffering. I don't know how many gems you've got around you. Since I was feeling very much in suffering, Louisa said, to the point of being unable to move, I was offering my little sufferings together with those of Jesus, which, of course, is what we're supposed to do all the time. And Jesus said, even the smallest item, the most smallest thing that you wouldn't even tell somebody else, if they're offered to him, he'll make them infinite. Okay, so I was offering them together with those of Jesus and with that intensity of love. Now, she's talking about motivation there, with which he intended to glorify the Father. Now, notice she's identifying with Jesus as she unites with him. She's actually telling you what to do, how to do it. And she was offering them to repair for our sins and to obtain all those goods for which he prayed for with his sufferings. And then she said, I said to myself, I will take it as if these sufferings were a martyrdom of mine. Of course, she's uniting them to Jesus' sufferings in his martyrdom, okay? As if the pains were the executioners, as if the bed was the cross. Well, I would consider the bed the cross if I was in it for 40 years, wouldn't you? And my immobility were the ropes that kept me bound. Okay. So as to render myself more dear and more loving to my highest good. But the executioners, I don't see them. So who is my the executioner that lacerates me and tears me to shreds, not only on the exterior of my body, but also in the most intimate parts, deep in my soul, to the point that I feel the circle of my life crack? She said, ah, my executioner is Jesus himself. Now, in volume 8, Jesus told her that love is a tyrant. It demands everything. That's in volume 8. Love is the tyrant. Now, in that little bit that we've just read, that's Louisa's first real insight into the deprivations of Jesus. She has already heard its martyrdom. She's already heard its martyrdom of love. But she has not actually identified all the parts with Jesus on the cross. And I call it her first real insight. It's a fantastic moment, okay? And so love is the tyrant, because in the Hours of the Passion, you'll be told that there was the passion of love, the passion of sins and the passion of the Jews. Do you remember? Mm-hmm. And the passion of love came from the Father. And that was the worst of them all. OK. So Louisa says, at that moment, almost in a flash, Jesus told me, my daughter, too great for you is the honour of having me as your executioner. Now, put that in English. The honour of having me as an executioner is too great. I mean, you don't deserve it. He said, I act like a groom, a bridegroom, who, having to espouse his bride and send her out in public in order to make her have a beautiful appearance and to make her worthy of himself, he trusts nobody, not even the spouse herself, but he himself wants to wash her, comb her, clothe her, adorn her with gems and diamonds. Now, beside that, put Ezekiel 16, verses 1 to 4. Because that is a summary of what you find in Ezekiel 16, where God says that he found Israel, his bride, in the wilderness. She had absolutely nothing, and he had to feed her and clothe her and do absolutely everything for her. Ezekiel 16, verses 1 to 14. Okay. And I had to wash her myself. Now, that's John 13, verses 1 to 12. Jesus washing the feet as a sign that he had to wash us all in his blood. Is that okay?
John 13, 1 to 12.
And this is a great honour for the bride, he said. More so, in other words, the Lord himself is looking after you. More so, since she will have no such concern. In other words, you don't. This is the exact opposite of Pelagianism, which is saving yourself. And you know, New Age is Pelagianism. Don't you know that? You're saving yourself. Okay. So she doesn't have to do anything. The Lord has done everything for her. Will I be pleasing to the spouse or not? The bride doesn't have to worry about that. Will he like the way I have adorned myself, or will he reproach me as a foolish one for not having been able to guess what would please him most? You don't have to think about that either. Isn't it brilliant? He said, that's the way it is with me, with my beloved spouses. Okay? The love I have for them is so great that I trust no one. Now notice the priest guiding Louisa is included. I am even forced to act as their executioner, but a loving one. Okay, and so I give her a wash or a comb and I clothe her. And you see now, why do you get the expression wash and a comb and I clothe her? Louisa's in a bed, unable to move, so somebody has to wash and comb the hair and do everything for her. Okay, so he says, I actually do this for you interiorly. and I bejewel her, okay, but not with the gems that come from earth, which are things that are superficial, rather with the gems that I make come out from the depth of her soul, from the most intimate parts, which are formed at the touch of my fingers. Now, Psalm 8, verse 3, says he created the universe with the tip of his fingers. That creates suffering. Now, the reason why I said that Psalm 8 says that with the tip of his fingers or the touch of his fingers, that he actually created the universe. Here he's saying that with the touch of his fingers, he's able to create suffering. So you see, in the last couple of volumes, we've noticed that Louisa says she has no external sufferings, and yet she's suffering terribly inside. He's saying, I'm able to create it for you. This is spiritual. And gradually she will come to realize that she's being crucified within. Only slowly. And that's why that insight at the beginning of this message is actually terribly important. Okay. So at the touch of my fingers that creates suffering, and from suffering come the gems. And the gems convert into gold, convert the will, sorry, into gold. And this will, converted into gold by my own hands, will send out all kinds of things. The most beautiful crowns, the most magnificent garments, the most fragrant flowers, the most pleasing, pleasant melodies. And with my own hands, as I have produced them, I keep arranging them to adorn her more and more. And all this happens with suffering souls. That means that you're talking mostly about victim souls. Okay. So am I not right in telling you, too great is the honour for you? So I have to give you Ephesians 2:10. Ephesians 2:10. We are God's work of art, created in Christ Jesus. I have to give you Philippians 1:6, that the Lord finishes a job that he starts unless you stop him. And I have to give you Deuteronomy 32:12. The Lord alone was her guide. Okay. In other words, you're getting back the scriptures just given to you in a personal experience. It's really fantastic. So May the 5th, 1909, sufferings impress the sanctity of Jesus in the soul. There's all kinds of sanctities, but there's only one sanctity of Jesus. As I was in my usual state, my good Jesus made himself heard just for a little, telling me with his sweet word, my daughter, mortifications, miseries, privations, sufferings, crosses, for those who will make use of them, they serve for nothing but to impress my own sanctity in the soul. And if she kept embellishing herself with all kinds, as if she had kept embellishing herself with all varieties of divine colours, even more, they are nothing other than many fragrances of heaven with which the soul remains all perfumed. Now, you have a good description there of the difference between Catholic theology and Protestant theology. If you've been involved in charismatic renewal, particularly if you've been very deeply in it, you probably didn't know that you were being influenced by an evangelical Protestant theology, which says Jesus did it all. You don't have to do anything. There's no sufferings, thank you very much. No cross, that was for him. You get healed of everything. You get all the gifts. You get powerful. You become great. He paid. You get the benefits. Now, that's totally the opposite of what you've just read here, where Jesus asks us to participate in the cross. to be part of him in redeeming the world. And he gets you to look away from your own body and to look away even from your own salvation. It's very difficult to get people to look away from that and to look through his eyes at the whole of humanity, past, present and future, and participate with him in their redemption so that you can be part of his triumph. It's a totally different theology.
Yeah.
And you just need to clarify that, because people coming in from prayer groups into Divine Will actually have a big problem because they don't know, they haven't worked out the influences that have been upon them. Now, they're not faulty. It's not their fault or anything. These are the influences that were upon them. It's taken me a good long time to work it out as well. But that's why some people can't take the Divine Will teachings at all, because they don't want the mortifications and the self-denial and the carrying of the cross and suffering and redeeming suffering. They don't want that at all. They forget about it. I've got to get healed of everything. I've got to walk on cushions to heaven, and I've got to be the powerful one. So I've met people in prayer groups. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with a prayer group, but I've met people in prayer groups who are fighting each other over, you know, I have this gift and you have that gift and the other gift. That's the exact opposite of this. Okay, we can talk about it later if you want. So the next one is May the 8th, 1909. This, I have a VIP on this one. Look at the heading. One who talks much is empty of God. Wow. Isn't that fantastic? So to prove it, I need to give you, put it beside the heading, literally, Proverbs 10:19. It's all about talk. Proverbs 10:19 and 12:18, Proverbs. And 13:3. Now, I only gave you three. There are 50. But Proverbs 13:3 says, there's life and death in the power of the tongue, and the person who uses it must eat the fruit thereof. I could kill somebody with my tongue. I mightn't kill them with a knife, but I can do it with my tongue very easily. Okay. So to give you Titus 1:10. Thank God this message isn't too long. Isn't it great? So continue in my usual state, Louisa said, my beloved Jesus made himself seen for just a little, and he told me, my daughter, one who talks much shows that he, she or it, and notice that I have a third gender, it, is empty in the interior. Now, right from the very beginning of the church, men and women have taken vows of silence to try and give God a chance and to hear God. So they've gone out into the deserts. Look at our wonderful testimony in Skellig Michael, where they went to live on literally on a rock so that they could hear God. Okay. While one who is filled with God, finding more, my book says taste. Yeah. Change that to satisfaction. Finding more satisfaction in his interior, does not want to lose this satisfaction, so he hardly speaks, and only out of necessity. Now, you will find that with people who grow closer and closer to God, they've less and less to say, and they certainly don't have small talk. And even while speaking, he never departs from his interior. That's the big bit. You need to put a VIP beside that one. In other words, you never lose the connection with the Lord. And he tries as much as he can to impress on others that which he feels within himself. Now, they'd hang you from the first tree nowadays for doing that. On the other hand, one who talks much is not only empty of God, but with his much talking, he tries to empty others of God as well. Isn't that something? Wow. So I want to give you Amos 5:13, and don't blame me. Amos 5:13. Read it yourselves. Okay. So May the 16th, 1909. The sun is a symbol of grace. Now, in these writings, the sun is a symbol of Jesus himself. who is the Son of Justice, you know. It's also a symbol of grace, but you may not remember back in volume 3, Jesus said, I am grace. Okay, I am grace. So, continuing my usual state, blessed Jesus came for just a little and he told me, my daughter, the Son is, we would say, a symbol of grace. When it finds a void, be it even a cave, a vault, a fissure, a hole, as long as there is empty space and a little opening through which to penetrate, the Son enters and finds, fills everything with light. In other words, give any kind of room and the light will find it. And if its light does not penetrate more, it's not because it lacks light, but rather because of the lack of space in which to be able to diffuse its light more. This is terribly important. It is the same with my grace, he said. It is more than a majestic sun. It envelops all creatures with its beneficial influence. However, it does not enter but into empty hearts. That's why we've been told from volumes 1 to 4 that we've to empty ourselves of self and selfishness and sin so to make room for grace to come in. And if grace can't get in, it means something is in there that is contrary to grace. But it'll only go into empty hearts. As much space as it finds, so much light does it let penetrate into the heart. This is why you got so much teaching on detachment in volumes 1 to 4. Now, the heart represents the real you, your inner self. It isn't just a Valentine symbol of romantic love. That's not the way it is in the scripture. So heart is used in the same way here as in the scriptures, means the real you inside, your persona. So these voids, spaces that you make for grace to come in, what are they? How are they formed? Number one, humility is the hoe which digs and forms, we would say the hole or the whatever. Number two, detachment from everything and also from oneself is the void itself. Now notice, the big thing about detachment is detachment from yourself. A person can appear to you religious and even holy. And the book of Proverbs says, never judge a man before he opens his mouth. And then you have a conversation with this holy person and they dig their heels in and they hold tenaciously to their own opinion, whether they're right or wrong. They're holding tenaciously to their own opinion, blah, blah, blah. That means self has a big S. Because if you were humble, you'd listen to somebody else's and you wouldn't impose your own. I'm just giving you that as a very simple way to make a little test. Is that okay? Very simple way. So detachment from oneself is actually more important than detachment from everything else. And to be detached from yourself, it's your own interests, your own opinion, your own this, your own that, your own value, all the things they tell you nowadays to sell yourself on, you're to be detached from. The window, in order to let the light come into the void, is trust in God. There's the third one. Now you start with humility, and the second one is detachment, and the third one is trust in God. And trust in God and distrust of ourselves. Now, distrust of ourselves is not this false thing that I have found all over the place in Ireland. Sure, I can't do that, you know what I mean? And they have a degree in music and they won't play a piano for you, you know what I mean? I mean, that's just ludicrous. That's false humility. Real humility, if you're able to play a piano, you'll play it and give everybody the joy of it. Do you know what I mean? That's real humility. You'll give it. The distrust of yourself is that you... The distrust of yourself is that you are not trying to save yourself, that you are relying on the Lord's grace to bring you through on everything. Is that okay? Therefore, as much trust as one has, so much does he enlarge the door. in order to let the light in and to take more grace. Now, St. Therese said, you will receive from God as much as you have confidence or trust in him. So the fourth one is the custodian that keeps the light and expands it is peace. So these are four things: humility, detachment, trust, and peace. That's a nice, clear little message for you. So May the 20th, 1909, we come back to the subject of love, which I've told you many times that the summary of these 36 volumes is divine will and love. They're the two main themes, okay? So the love for God surpasses everything else. So Louisa says, continuing in my usual state, Jesus just barely made himself seen in a flash of light. Why? Because God is light, 1 John 1:5. Do you want to put it in there? Mm-hmm. Flash of light, 1 John 1:5. And he told me, my daughter, there's nothing that can surpass love. So beside that, I want you to put 1 Corinthians 14:1 at the side. 1 Corinthians 14:1, you must want love more than anything else. Okay. Neither doctrine nor dignity, and much less nobility. At the most, one who uses those for the good of making speculations around my being can know me more or less. Now, he's talking about the theologians and these people, you know, who talk more than anything else. He says they get to know you a little bit. But one who reaches the point of making me his own object, that is love. The only one who really gets to know God is the one who reaches out to him personally, to his heart, which is love. So that's 1 Corinthians 13:1-13. Now, who reaches the point of eating me as one does with food? That's love. How can you eat him in the Eucharist? You also eat his word. One who loves me devours me. Well, Louisa certainly does. And one who loves me finds my being identified with each particle of his being. Now, there's the union with God. It's not just some ethereal, mystical thing up in the ether, but literally every part of your being is identified with him. There is as much difference between one who really loves me and, you need to add the word, all the others. Whatever their conditions or qualities may be, as between one who knows a precious object, appreciates it, esteems it, but it doesn't belong to him. So they're the scholars who can talk about it backwards and frontwards. Okay. And one who possesses that object because it's his own. So when St. Bernadette of Lourdes was brought in from the fields at the age of 11 to receive Holy Communion, she was asked, who is God? And she said, God is love. And the nun told her it was the wrong answer. That wasn't the answer in the book. But she was correct. It's 1 John 4:7-17. God is love. And so Bernadette came in with the knowledge that was in her soul that she had loved God all this time. Can the rest of you turn off your mobiles? Who is more fortunate than these, Jesus says, the one who knows about it or the one who possesses it? Certainly the one who possesses it. That's like saying, who is the most unfortunate? The one looking at the television at somebody else having won the lottery. Can you turn it off? Is it the person looking at the television with somebody else having celebrating winning the lottery, or actually winning it yourself? That's what he's saying. One possesses it and the other doesn't. So love makes, watch this now, this is terribly important. Love makes up for doctrine and surpasses it. Now that's the example I've already given to you about Saint Bernadette. She didn't have the words that the nun had in the nun's book, but she had the knowledge in her heart. It makes up for dignity and surpasses all dignities. That is, if I, as an absolute nobody in the church, love God to the nth degree, and you have a cardinal who doesn't, then the cardinal misses out. So it makes up for the dignity, okay? Providing one with divine dignity, you see, and that's why we declare some people saints, that the dignity they have acquired is divine. So love makes up for everything and surpasses everything. Love is it. Why is love it? Because God is love. And God is love, 1 John 4, 7 to 17. Okay. Now you see, there are people in the church who will tell you getting your degree in theology is more important than anything else. And the Lord says, no, it's your degree in love. Yeah. So May the 22nd, 1909, we're at love again. Okay, and I want to give you Ephesians 3, verses 14 to 21. That is, you must be grounded in love, built on love, and reach the fullness of love. So this morning, Louisa said, I received communion. Blessed Jesus did not come. And after waiting for a long time between vigil and sleep, in seeing that time was passing and Jesus was not coming, I wanted to go out of my sleep. But at the same time, I wanted to stay because of the torment I felt in my heart and not seeing it. Now, this sleep is not sleep in bed. This is the very deep state of a person in prayer, but they're not actually in ecstasy. Is that okay? It's a very deep state of prayer. It looks like sleep to somebody outside of it. And it's very often called sleep as well, but it's not actually sleep. I felt like a baby who, wanting to sleep and being wakened by force, starts making fusses and cries. However, in my fussing while striving to wake up, I said in my interior, what a bitter separation. She's not asleep, is she? I feel lifeless and yet I live, but this is harder than death. However, may your privation be for love of you. Now you see she's getting the message, okay? For love of you, the bitterness I feel. For love of you, my tormented heart. For love of you, the life I don't feel, though I live. But so that it may be more acceptable to you, I unite this suffering of mine to the intensity of your love. And with mine, I offer you your own love. Now, first of all, she offers the pains that she names out of love for him. And then she says, no, I want to go further. I want to unite it with your love so that my acts of love are divine. Isn't that fantastic? Yes. Now, she has at long last discovered what to do with her privations. She wasn't exactly asleep, was she? But as I was saying this, Jesus moved in my interior and he told me how sweet and delightful in my hearing is the note of love. Why, everything is about love. Okay. Matthew 22. I only remembered it this second. And I can't remember the verses right now where Jesus says that the whole law and the prophets hang on the law of love. The whole law. And when he says hang on that, they rabbis, when they were discussing things together, they would say, but such and such a point hangs on such and such a text and such a thing hangs. And Jesus said the whole of scripture hangs on love God and love your neighbor. He said that this is it. This is the essence. It's the center of everything. I think it's verses 22 to 24. I think so. And if I'm wrong, you can correct it in your own book. Yet he said he loves to hear the note of love. Say it again, he said. Repeat it again. Cheer my hearing with these notes of love. Now, any human lover would say the same thing to their beloved, wouldn't they? Mm-hmm. Say it again. Yeah. Even a child will say it. Mm-hmm. Say it again. Yeah, and a mother will say it to a child. Say it again. Because there's nothing more beautiful than to hear someone speaking to you of love. And he says that's so harmonious, which descend deep into my heart and sweeten all of me. Because what the Lord is has loved us infinitely and is looking for love in return. Now, God's infinite love is Jeremiah 31, 30, 31:3. Jeremiah 31:3. I've loved you with an everlasting love, and I am constant.
In my affection.
Yeah.
31:3.
So who would believe it? I'm ashamed to say it, Louisa said. In my huffiness, I answered, I don't want to say it. Can you imagine? Now try and imagine the level that this woman is at. That's what gets me every time. You get sweetened and I get more embittered. You wouldn't think she was talking to a divine person, would you? My sweet Jesus kept silent. Watch this now. As though being displeased with my answer. Well, he should be. And as soon as I woke up, I repeated my notes of love many times. However, he did not let himself be heard or seen for the whole day. Guess who was displeased? And he's well able to show it. Okay, so May the 25th, 1909, God's love for us. You often find a whole group of texts dealing with the same subject. So the heading here is Jesus confounds the soul with love. Continuing in my usual state, blessed Jesus was not coming. However, for the whole day, I felt as if there was somebody over me. He's there. He keeps telling her he's with her all the time. Who would not let me waste 1 minute of time, but would keep me always in continuous prayer. A thought wanted to distract me by saying to me, when the Lord doesn't come, you pray more, you're more attentive. And by this, you yourself give him the field not to come. Because the Lord would say, since she behaves better when I don't go, it's better for me not to come. Since I would not waste time in listening to what my thought was saying, she obviously listened enough for it to be able to tell us. In order to shut the door on its face, I said, the more he doesn't come, the more I will confound him with love. Okay. Now, lovers do say things that are in excess. Okay. I will confound him with love. Imagine confounding love itself. Okay. I don't want to give him the occasion. This is what I can do. And this is what I want to do. And he is free to do whatever he wants. Talk about someone being huffy. Mm-hmm. And without thinking of the nonsense that my thought had told me, I continued to do what I was supposed to do. In the evening, however, I didn't even remember about this. But blessed Jesus came, almost smiling at me, and he told me, bravo, bravo, my lover, he said, who wants to confound me with love. However, I tell you, you will never confound me. Why? She's a creature and he's the creator. And if sometimes it seems that I am confounded with love, it is I who give you the freedom to do it. John 15:5, without me, you can do nothing. Because the only relief and the thing that I most enjoy from creatures is love. In fact, it was I who solicited you to pray, who prayed with you, who gave you no respite. She suspected it was him, of course. So instead of me being confounded, I confounded you with love. And since you felt all filled with love and were confounded by it, in seeing that my love was pouring so much into you, you thought that you were confounding me with love. Talk about getting it upside down. However, I tell you, as long as you try to love me more, I delight in these mistakes of yours and I make them a little game between you and me. Not a joke. He never jokes. Okay. So July the 14th, 1909 is about peace. Another major topic, because love, joy and peace. Do you remember? So Philippians 4:7. The peace that passes all understanding. Philippians 4:7. I've gone through a most bitter time because of the privation of blessed Jesus, Louisa said. At most, he would make himself seen like shadow and lightning, and sometimes even the lightning would seem to be running away. My mind was troubled by this thought, how cruelly he has left me, Jesus, who is so good. Maybe it wasn't him who used to come. His goodness would not have done this to me. Who knows whether it was the devil or my fantasy or dreams. But in my inmost soul, I did not want to hear this, naturally enough, because it wasn't right. It wanted to remain at peace. And this is very important. She's showing you that if you're getting disturbed thoughts on the outside that you just go away from them and go into your interior. Now, Louisa isn't the first holy person to tell us that. All the saints have told us that even if you're in prayer and you're being distracted by a thought, just simply neglect it and get on in more interior with your prayer and let the thought come and go without giving it any attention. And then Satan can't use it to really get you. Okay. That's what she's saying. I didn't want to hear this. I wanted to stay at peace. So I didn't want to be annoyed with anything. It would penetrate more and more into the will of God. You see, you go deeper and deeper. Okay. My soul would hide in the divine will. That's the it. Falling into a profound sleep. You see, now that sleep is not sleep as you know it. It's deep contemplation. Okay? It's a contemplative state. And there's no way to wake up. But the language for that sleep is Psalm 131. My soul is like a weaned child on its mother's lap. And it seems that good Jesus encloses it so much in his will that he does not allow one to find even the door in order to knock and to let it hear that Jesus has left it. And so it sleeps and it remains in peace. That's Psalm 127, verse 2 as well. Psalm 127, verse 2. Receiving no answer, the mind says to itself, am I the only one to take this bile? Look at this. I too want to become calm and to do the will of God. Whatever comes, let it come. And as long as I do the will of God. So what she's saying is, no matter what comes, I'm going to stay only doing the will of God. There's the choice that keeps you out of all trouble and keeps Satan at bay, because he cannot touch someone who chooses to do the will of God. Now, this morning, as I was thinking of what I'd said above, good Jesus told me, my daughter, if these were fantasies, what's going on between her and him, dreams, demons, they would not have so much strength as to make you possess the halo of peace. 1 Corinthians 14:33. In other words, anything coming from the demon cannot have the fruit of peace. That's number one. Okay. And not just for one day, but for 25 years she's now in the bed. A quarter of a century. No one could have made that aura of sweet peace breeze inside and outside of you. Only the one who is all peace. Romans 15:33. Ephesians 2:4. Okay. So only the one who is all peace. And if a breath of disturbance could surprise him, he would cease to be God. His majesty would be obfuscated, his greatness would shrink, his power would be weakened. In sum, the whole of the divine being would receive a shake. But the one who possesses you, whom you possess, 1 Thessalonians 5:23, the one who possesses you and whom you possess is over you. He watches over you continuously for any breath of disturbance. Okay? I also want to give you Song of Songs 2:4. Remember that in all of my comings, I have always corrected you if there was a breath of disturbance in you. Now, you get that very specifically from volumes 1-4. Just put V1-4 beside that, because that's where he was training her to stay in peace no matter what happened.
Volumes what?
1-4. So remember that in all of my comings, I have always corrected you if there was a breath of disturbance in you. And nothing would displease me more than not seeing you in perfect peace. Isaiah 26:3. It is the Lord who keeps us in perfect peace. and only then would I disappear from you when I would see you all peaceful again. Fantasy and dreams, and much less the devil, do not have this power. My book says virtue. And even less could they give it to others. Therefore, calm yourself and do not be ungrateful. Okay. So July the 24th, 1909, still we're talking about love. Everything the soul does out of love for God enters into him and is transformed into his own works. That's why it's so essential to do absolutely everything, no matter how small, no matter how trivial, to do it for love of him. And if you're not going to remember it, just make the intention and say, Lord, I make the intention that every single thing I do this day is out of love for you. Whether I forget it or not, that's my intention. And so you've set your compass. So I was thinking of the misery of my present state, and I said to myself how everything is over for me, how good Jesus has forgotten about everything. She loves that. He no longer remembers my hardships, the sufferings I've gone through and all these years in bed. And so my mind kept going back to some specialities of suffering and the gravest ones which I've gone through. At that moment, Blessed Jesus told me, my daughter, everything, and you really need to ring that one, everything that is done for love of me enters into me, becomes part of him, and is transformed into my own works. And since my works are for the good of all, you see, that's one of the absolute things about divine will. It's for everybody. It's universal. That is for the pilgrim souls, the purging souls, and the triumphant souls. Everything you have done and suffered for me is present in me, because everything in the divine will is present. Isn't that right? And does its office for the good of all, just as my works do. Would you rather take them back within yourself? Notice, he says, seems to think that that's possible. Isn't that frightening? Louisa answered, may it never be, Lord, she said. But in spite of this, I continue to think about it, being a little distracted from my usual interior work. And good Jesus repeated, you don't want to stop it. I'm going to make you stop it. And he placed himself in my interior, praying in a loud voice, saying all that I was supposed to say. And on seeing this, I remained confused and I followed good Jesus. And when he saw that I was no longer paying attention to anything else, then he kept silent and I remained alone doing what I was supposed to do. Now, there's several things going on there. One is, he expects that when he has answered something, she'll drop it. But sometimes we don't drop it. We're like the dog going back to the bone, aren't we? And he says to her, you must have this control. Stop it. And since she couldn't do it, he said, I'm going to make you do it. And since he is present in her interior in a way that is totally outstanding, because he's bilocated himself in her interior, he started praying loudly in her interior what she was supposed to be doing until she got the message. And then when she started doing what she should have been doing, he stopped. Look who steps in. Do you remember the story of the footprints?
Oh, yeah, he's carrying you.
He's carrying you. And he's doing it when you're not able to do it.
Yes.
And you have the extraordinary example of the humility of God there. Okay. So July the 27th, 1909, we're talking about total surrender to the divine will. This is where we're going. And the heading that's given to you mightn't help, and that is, the soul is the toy of Jesus. Well, if he's a child and he's playing with the toy, okay. As I was in my usual state, I thought to myself, what am I here for? I'm no longer good for anything. He does not come, and I have remained as a useless object, because without him I am worth nothing. That's your John 15:5. That's a literal quotation there. I suffer nothing. So why keep me on the earth any longer? And he just flashing by told me, my daughter, I keep you for fun. And toys are not always kept in one's hands. Many times they are not touched even for months and months. But in spite of this, when the owner of that toy wants it, one does not cease to form. It does not cease to form his enjoyment, not amusement, enjoyment. Do you perhaps want me to have not even one toy on the earth? Let me enjoy myself, knock out the amuse again. Let me enjoy myself with you on earth as I please. And in exchange, I will let you enjoy yourself with me forever. That's not a bad exchange, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you remember the writings of St. Therese of Lisieux, she compared herself to a little ball that the child Jesus would play with and that he could kick into a corner and forget about it. And he could even neglect it and everything. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. She had an extraordinary understanding of this. It's just an image, of course, being the plaything. It is that you're totally surrendered. That's why I gave you the heading, mm-hmm. totally surrendered to the Lord, and that he can carry out his will in you unhindered. So that's why I gave you my own heading there, which I think says it better. So July the 29th, 1909, we're back to peace again. Notice all these central themes coming back. Peace is a divine virtue. So continuing in my usual state, I said to myself, why does the Lord absolutely want no breath of disturbance, volumes 1-4, enter into me, and that in all things I remain at peace? It seems that nothing pleases him, watch this now, but that even great works, heroic virtues, atrocious sufferings, it seems that he sniffs in the soul. I think it's fascinating the way she reacts to him, you know. He sniffs around. And with all those things, if she has no peace, he remains nauseated and displeased with the soul. At that moment, it's funny, isn't it? He made himself heard, and with dignified and imposing voice, he doesn't like being told he sniffs around, does he? He answered my why. Now, my friends, when we get to volume 14, he has a whole section on why. And he says, the why in adults comes from hell.
Yeah.
The why of a child doesn't, because when a child is opening up, they've got to find out why is that called a cup and why is that called a plate and all the rest of it. All their whys are fine. He says the why of the adult is wrong. In other words, we're questioning God, we question his will, we question his ways, we question his scriptures, we question his grace, we question. And he said you should surrender instead. So that's why he's coming to her in an imposing way. He doesn't like the why. Peace, he said, is a divine virtue, while the other virtues are human. Now, this is a pronouncement rather than just a teaching. So any virtue, if it is not crowned with peace, cannot be called virtue, but vice. Isn't that amazing? Mm. This is why I cherish peace so much, because peace is the surest sign, underline, that one suffers and works for me. And it is the heritage that I give to my children. You see, that's a pronouncement. I give it to my children. It is of the eternal peace that they will enjoy in heaven. Okay. So I have to give you a whole lot of stuff here. Luke 1:79 and 2:14. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. And there's peace to anybody of goodwill in 2:14. Okay. John 14:27. Peace I give you, not as the world gives peace. John 16:33. And John 20:19-20. And there's lots more, Old and New Testament. So August 2nd, 1909, the soul is a toy made of gold and diamonds. So we're going back to the toy subject. I was thinking of what I wrote on the 27th of last month, she said, and I said to myself, I thought I was something in the hands of the Lord. I'm only a toy. I love this. Now, the problem here is nothingness. You know, I thought I was something. Now I discover I'm only a toy. That's terribly important. I remember asking a group of teenagers in Africa, oh, back in the 1960s, what did they want to become? And they wanted to become all kinds of things. But one little girl stood up and she was in the back of the class and she said, I want to be a very important somebody. I said, you're the only one who told the truth. I said, everybody wants to be a very important somebody to somebody. It's husband to wife, parent to child, friend to friend. Do you know what I mean? But I want to be a very important somebody by itself is wrong. In other words, I want to be the exalted one.
Yes.
But God actually called us to be a very important somebody to somebody, whether that somebody is singular or plural. Okay. So here she's playing with this thing. And these messages are for us. They're not really for her. I'm nothing but a toy. What a most wretched object I am. Now, the Lord's putting this in here in case anybody had theological problems with the last one. Okay. So, toys can be made of clay, earth, paper, flabby elastic band. They had elastic band in 1909. Isn't that interesting? Such that it's sufficient that they fall on the ground or just the slightest inconvenience and they break. They didn't have plastic, you see. And no longer being useful for the game, they're thrown away. Oh my good, how oppressed I feel at the thought that one day or another you'll throw me away. And good Jesus made himself heard and told me, my daughter, do not oppress yourself. When toys are made of wretched matter, they break and one throws them away. But when they're made of gold or diamonds, and he told her that in the last one as well, or of any precious material, one has them fixed. And they always serve to form the enjoyment of the one who has the good of possessing them. So you are for me. Now, what does he mean by gold and diamonds? You are precious in my eyes. Okay, that's what he's saying. Now that I've used the words, you are precious, I'm going to write them down. You are precious in my eyes. Eyes, and I love you. That's Isaiah 43. The text had to come to me first. I can't remember the verse at the moment, but that's the text. You are precious in my eyes and I love you. So gold and diamonds is precious, okay? So a toy made of diamonds and a purest gold because you have my image in you. That's Genesis 2:7. And it's Romans 8:29. Genesis 2:7. And Romans 8:29. You have my image in you. And because I paid the price of my blood to purchase you. Now look at the gold and the diamonds. They're the image of God and the precious blood that redeemed us. Notice the preciousness is not in ourselves. So what do you think she's being talked about here? Her nothingness. Isn't that it? So it's the precious blood to purchase you, and you are adorned with the likeness of my sufferings. Therefore, you are not a wretched object that I would throw away. Rather, it costs me very much. You can be tranquil. There's no danger I'll throw you away. Okay. So October the 1st, 1909. Watch this one now. Jesus counts, weighs and measures everything in the soul. I don't know if what your reaction to that is, but mine is, ouch. Okay, you don't want everything measured, do you? Some things, yeah. Okay. Being very afflicted because of my poor state, Louisa said, I felt nauseating to myself. I think that's the most wonderful confession. Have you ever been nauseating to yourself? It's terribly important that if you go through a spate in which you're so out of sorts and out of kilter with everything, it's actually the height of charity to tell whoever you live with and work with, just keep a space between me and you. I'm not civil. Don't talk to me until I come round. It's actually terribly important. I don't know, have you ever even said to the Lord in a time of crisis? I have. When you'd be going through a crisis inside, I say, Lord, just hold on to me until I come round. And the images of a mother holding a child in a tantrum And you just hold the child, and if you have any wisdom, you'll say nothing. You just hold the child, give the child the strength of your body and the strength of your love, and the child will eventually calm down, and later on then you can have a discussion. But if you take on the tantrum, you're going to have no discussion, isn't that right?
Yeah.
Okay, so that's us being nauseating to ourselves, and it is an experience that we do have. And she said, I must be abominable before God. I felt as if the Lord had left me halfway on the path, and without him, I feel I cannot go on any further. I feel he no longer wants to use me in order to spare the world the chastisements. Now, this is very, very important. She's having a shift in her vocation, and there's nobody to tell her what's going on. The priest has got to wait until messages come from the Lord. He doesn't know what's going on. It's only then he knows. So she's from we're in volume 9. So in volume 9, she begins to shift away from being the victim soul, taking the crown of thorns and crucifixion and all the rest of it, to this interior suffering that she's been talking about in the last few messages. And she is going to be used as the key to open the kingdom of the divine will for everybody else. Now, that vocation is unknown in the church, so the priest can't help her. She doesn't know what's going on, and so she actually suffers greatly in the turnaround. Okay, and we need this, because once you get into volume 11, then she's on the high road of the divine will. So here she's saying, I notice he's not using me, you see, to stop to spare the chastisements. So that means that the victim soul bit is being drawn back. And so he has moved crosses and thorns away from me. He has discontinued all my sharing in the passion and the communications. The only thing I see is that he's on the alert that I remain in peace. That's the important bit, that she must stay in peace while this transformation is happening. It's very hard on her because she doesn't know where it's going. And we don't like things happening to us that we don't know where it's going, do we? My God, what pain, she said. If you yourself did not keep me distracted by these losses and crosses of you, that's the deprivations, and of everything, I would die of grief, she said. If it wasn't for your holy will, into what a sea of troubles I would have fallen. Oh, keep me always in your holy will. This is enough for me. And it isn't, you know, because she'll be back complaining again. Now, as I was in my usual state, I was crying and saying to myself, good Jesus has taken me into no account. And she said it's enough, and she goes on complaining. See what I mean? he has taken me into no account of the years of bed nor of the sacrifices. Nothing. Otherwise, he would not have left me, and I cried and I cried. The Song of Songs 3, verses 1 to 2. Song of Songs, SS 3, verses 1 to 2. That's the bride has lost the bridegroom, and she goes frantic. Okay.
What's Song of Songs?
3, verses 1 to 2. So at that moment, I felt a move in my interior, and I lost consciousness. That means she went into ecstasy. And also outside of myself into an out-of-the-body condition. And I kept crying. Then, as if a door had opened in my interior, I saw Jesus. I felt huffy, and I didn't say anything to him. I just kept crying. And he told me, calm yourself, stop crying. Do not cry. I feel my heart touched, and I faint with love for you. Now, I faint with love for you is Song of Songs 2:5. Song of Songs 2:5, and also Song of Songs 5:8. Do you want to increase my pains because of your love? Then, assuming a majestic air, as though sitting on a throne within my heart, he seemed to hold a pen in his hand and to write. And that's not usually a picture we have of Jesus, is it?
Yeah.
And turning to me, he said, see, whether I do not take things into account. What's the writing? It's the books of heaven. Do you remember that everything's written in the books? Not only the years in bed, the sacrifices, but even the thoughts you have for me. I am writing your affections, your desires, everything, even that which you will suffer. So let me give you two, before you move on, two references for the Lamb's Book of Life, okay, because it's the Book of Life he's writing in. It's Revelation 20:12, Revelation 20:12 and 21:27. The Lamb's Book of Life, everything is written in it. So he said, everything that which you want to do or suffer, but you don't, because I don't concede it to you. Now notice, he's saying to her, she wants to suffer to relieve humanity of chastisements, and he takes it as if it was done. Now, we had that in a huge way in the life of Saint Therese of Lisieux. She wanted to be a priest, she wanted to be a missionary, she wanted to be a teacher, she wanted to be this and that and the other, and the Lord said, done. What does he say in divine will? You desire it, I do it. Okay. So when we truly want to do something, but we are not in the position of being able to do it, and we say to the Lord, I would love to help those poor people in Uganda, but there's no possibility at all of me going there. I would love to do it. He takes it as done. Isn't it fantastic? Yeah, it's really beautiful. So I count, weigh and measure everything so that nothing may be lost and you may be repaid for everything. And as I write, I keep it in my own heart. Okay. Do you remember Peter the Apostle saying to Jesus, and what are we going to get? We left everything. And then Jesus told him that you will get 100% of houses. I don't know if you want 100 houses for one. 100% of fathers. No, one was enough. 100% of mothers. No, one was enough. For me, anyway. 100% of brothers. No, one was enough. Definitely. 100% of sisters. No, I've got 7. That's enough. What was he saying? And you know, the strange thing is, he was talking to Jewish people. And the last thing on the planet a Jewish man wanted was 100% of sisters. Why? Because they had the same job then as the Muslim men have now, that you have to keep the girls pure and holy until their marriage. And you have to ensure that they are a virgin on the day of their wedding. Oh, they didn't want 100 of them. So what was he saying? Isn't it fascinating? He was using all that imagery, and when you just look at it, who needs 100 houses?
Yeah.
You don't.
No.
But all that elaborate imagery was just simply saying, you've no idea of the reward that God has for you in heaven, even for the smallest thing you've given up. You know, and Paul says that in Romans 8. Now, Romans 8. Now, I've only just thought of it this minute, so I haven't got the verse. He says that the sufferings in this life are nothing compared to the glory that is prepared for us.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Louisa then says, I don't know, but I found myself inside of Jesus while before I was in my interior. It seemed that the head of Jesus was in place of my head, and all of my members served as his body. You can see the full identification there. Mm-hmm. That's Galatians 2:20. I no longer live, Christ lives in me. And he repeated, see how I keep you like the members of my own body. And then he disappeared. After a little while, as I continued to be afflicted, bursting into crying every now and then, Jesus came back and told me, my daughter, courage, I have not left you. That's Joshua 1:5. I will not leave you. Joshua 1:5. And John 14:18. John 14:18, where Jesus said, I will not leave you orphans. Okay. I've not left you. Rather, I am hidden. Because if I let myself be seen as before, you would bind me everywhere and I would not be able to chastise the world in anything. Now, he's been telling her that for 9 volumes, hasn't he? And I would not be able to chastise. Okay. nor have I left you halfway on the path. Don't you remember that these last years of your life are? These are years wanted by your confessor. He asked for them. Okay. Don't you remember that not once, but as many as four or five times you found yourself fighting with me? I wanted to take you with me, that is, in death. Okay. And you would tell me that obedience didn't want it. And while I had prepared you in order to take you with me, I was forced to leave you on earth again. Look now at the consequences you are bearing. Isn't that interesting? Mm-hmm. These are years of pause and patience. Isaiah 40:31. Those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings like the eagle. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Okay.
Isaiah 40:31.
So these are years of pause and of patience. Charity and obedience have their own thorns. In other words, their own price, which open large wounds and make the heart bleed. But they make the most ruby red, fragrant and beautiful roses bloom. Now, we all know that the blood red rose represents the Lord and his passion. In fact, in seeing in your confessor the fruit of his goodwill and his charity and the fear that the world might be chastised, because of this, I somehow concurred with him. But if I had not found anybody who would pray me and interpose himself, you would certainly not be here. He says you're alive because the confessor says it. But you remember back in volumes 3 and 4 that you got an obedience not to die. Do you remember that? Mm. But come, courage. The exile will not be too long after all. Oh, the poor girl. She doesn't die until she's in her 80s. And I promise you that the day will come when I will not let myself be overcome by anyone. She died during the night, didn't she? Mm-hmm. And they didn't even know she was dead the following day. They just thought she was in ecstasy. So she got plenty of chance to get out, if I can put it that way. Louisa said, who can tell in what bitterness I swim? Comforted Jess, but in bitter down to the marrow of my bones. I cannot remember this without crying. So much so that in telling it to the confessor, the heat of my tears was such that it seemed I would get upset with him. Why would she get upset at him? Because the Lord blamed him. It's all your fault. Okay. And I truly said to him, you've been the cause of my troubles. Now, if that's all she said, it was very mild. Okay. I'm going to stop there now because we're going to a different subject and the time is up.